so difficult for Americans to eat well? That's the question our next guest set out to answer in her book, The American Way of Eating. Tracy McMillan picked peaches in the orchards of Central California, worked as a stock clerk at Walmart, and also at America's largest restaurant chain, Applebee's, to find out what it's like to be on the front lines of our food system and what lower-income Americans can afford to eat. So what is the American way of eating, and how is that changing? It's your call with me, Holly Kernan, and you, after this news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The French authorities say the man suspected of shooting dead Jewish children, a rabbi and soldiers in southern France, was planning another attack before police trapped him. A prosecutor said the attack was due to take place today, and the intended targets were another soldier and two police officials. The suspect, Mohamed Merah, who's of Algerian origin, has been cornered by police at an apartment building in Toulouse. The French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, says he won't escape justice.
The police, gendarmerie and the justice, thanks to their work, have managed to identify the suspect killer. And as I speak to you, he is encircled by the forces of security and he is under siege. This man wanted to make the Republic kneel. The Republic did not give in. It wasn't weakened.
The UN Security Council has given its backing to a peace plan for Syria, put forward by its envoy, Kofi Annan. In a statement, the Council urged the Syrian government and its opponents to implement Mr. Annan's proposals immediately. From the United Nations, here's Nada Torfik.
The statement expresses full support for Mr. Annan's plan to bring an end to all violence in Syria, secure humanitarian access, and to facilitate a political transition. The statement does not carry the legal authority of a resolution. For months, council members have been unable to agree on a course of action to the Syrian crisis that has claimed the lives of over 8,000 civilians. Russia and China have twice vetoed attempts at a resolution, but diplomats hope this statement will intensify pressure on Mr. Assad to work cooperatively with Mr. Annan.
Troops in the center of Mali's capital, Bamako, are reported to have taken control of state television, which has stopped broadcasting. Gunfire has been heard in the city, and armored vehicles have sealed off the presidential palace. The soldiers are angry about the conduct of the military campaign against Tuareg-led rebels, who seized areas in the north of the country. Earlier, shots were fired at a barracks north of the city by protesting troops, following a visit by the Minister of Defense. Lawyers in China have been told that for the first time, they'll have to swear an oath of allegiance to the ruling Communist Party. The change is opposed by lawyers who've defended critics of the government. Abby Maudsley of our Asia-Pacific desk has more.
The Chinese Justice Ministry says that all lawyers wanting to obtain or renew their professional license will now have to pledge their loyalty to the country and support for the leadership of the party. The ministry said the oath was intended to raise lawyers' political, professional and moral standards. In recent years, the Chinese authorities have increased pressure on lawyers who take on politically sensitive cases or use the legal system to push for greater civil liberties. Some of these lawyers have already expressed concern at the announcement.
Abby Maudsley, you're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. Officials in Vietnam say that China has detained 21 Vietnamese fishermen on an island in the South China Sea. They say the men and their two boats were intercepted by Chinese forces when fishing near the disputed Paracel Islands earlier this month. The area is believed to be rich in oil and natural gas reserves. A British woman held hostage for 6 months in Somalia has arrived in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, after being released. A ransom was reportedly paid to secure Judith Tebbutt's freedom from her Somali captors. She was kidnapped by a gang of six men at a holiday resort in northern Kenya. Her husband was shot dead during the attack, but Mrs. Tebbutt said she hadn't realised that at the time.
I didn't know he died till about, I think it was 2 weeks from my capture. I just assumed he was alive, but then my son told me he died. That was difficult.
Mrs. Tebbutt said she was looking forward to seeing her son. She thanked the BBC World Service, saying it had kept her going. A Libyan government delegation has left Mauritania without the former Libyan intelligence chief, Abdullah Assanoussi, who was detained there last week. Earlier, Libya's deputy prime minister, Mustafa Abu Shagour, said he'd secured a promise of Mr. Sanusi's extradition from the Mauritanian president. Mr. Sanusi was considered to be Colonel Gaddafi's right-hand man. He's wanted for alleged crimes against humanity during last year's uprising. A school in Tanzania, which caused outrage among AIDS activists by making HIV-positive children wear red ribbons, has changed its policy. The headmaster at Kibaha Primary School, west of the largest city, Dar es Salaam, told the BBC that the ribbons had now been removed. It's thought parents had approved of the idea of wearing them. BBC News.
What is the American way of eating? And why is it so hard for lower-income Americans to access and consume healthy food? Those are some of the questions our guest Tracy McMillan set out to answer in her new book. She picked garlic and peaches in California's Central Valley, worked at Walmart and Applebee's, and she chronicles those experiences in The American Way of Eating. She says her grandmother taught her that spending time and money on cooking and preparing meals was for fancy people. And it is easier to grab processed foods than it is to grow and cook your own food. In fact, many unhealthy foods are subsidized in our society. So today we'll have a conversation about how we eat in this country, the conditions in which those who pick our food are working, and how race, class, and geography affect food availability and choices. What do you consider to be good food? And can you afford it? Is it available in your neighborhood? Joining us today is Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farmfields, and The Dinner Table. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Holly.
Thank you for being here. It's great to meet you. So I want you to tell us about your experiences in California's fields and at Applebee's and at Walmart. But I'm wondering, why did you choose these three places? What was the idea there?
Sure. So the idea behind the book was that I really wanted to dive into the heart of how America gets its food as it currently exists, right? So I didn't really want to look at the wonderful sort of innovations that are going on. I wanted to see sort of what it looks like for most Americans, and that's industrial agriculture. And I also wanted to look at eating well, right? And one of the few rules, right, that has not changed since I was a kid about eating well is eat your vegetables, right?
Right.
And so I said, okay, I want to go and look at how we grow and sort of transport and move around fresh fruits and vegetables. So for agriculture, that meant going to California. You guys in the Central Valley, I think about 40% of the food in the U.S. is grown.
Mm-hmm.
Salinas Valley grows a huge share of our vegetables. And then from there, right, I wanted to see where do people actually buy their food. And that meant Walmart, because Walmart's the largest grocer in the U.S. and the world right now. It's responsible for about a quarter of our food distribution. And then from there, right, I wanted to look at eating. And I decided that, particularly at the time when I was reporting the book proposal, so this is before the economy crashed in 2008, Americans were spending just under 50% of their food budgets on restaurants. So I said, well, what restaurant do most Americans go to? And Applebee's came up. It's the biggest one in the U.S. and the world. And even if folks don't go there all the time, I think most Americans have at least been to one, right? Like they're really common off of highway exits and things like that. And so I said, okay, so I'll take these three icons of American food and use those as a way to dive into the story of how our food system works now.
All right, so what did you find? What was it like to work in California's fields? Who else was working there? What were the living conditions like? What was your experience?
So farm work in California was surprisingly shocking to me, right? I did a lot of research and I said, okay, it's going to be hard, it'll be hot, I'll probably make like minimum wage. And it was definitely hard and hot. I didn't really make minimum wage whenever I was working fully undercover. There was one period in the book where the supervisor of the company knew I was a journalist, but nobody I worked with did. Anytime people didn't know I was a journalist, I was paid straight piece rate. And that meant I generally earned between $2 and $4 an hour.
And is that legal?
No, that's completely illegal in California. There are certain piece rate exemptions that exist in other states because it's not covered under federal law. But here in California, you have to earn minimum wage, even if you're working working at piece rate. So
how widespread is it that folks are just earning a piece rate that does not even come close to minimum wage? Right.
I saw that extensively. I was generally speaking working and living in communities that had a high proportion of undocumented immigrants. And so, you know, that's going to pre-select for the worst performing companies. But what really sort of struck me is that, you know, I had done reporting before I went into the fields. I've done reporting since then. And every grower I ever talk to says there's no way that could possibly be happening. There might be a fly-by-night contractor here or there, but that just doesn't happen. The contractors I worked for were documenting that they were underpaying people. It was something that, you know, had I chosen to argue about, right? I could have said, look, I have proof here that I was in the field for 9 hours and you gave me $16 and that my paycheck says I was there for 2 hours. Why does that not match up? And sort of, you know, my thinking is if companies are so comfortable that they're able to just document that they're cheating people and assume that no one's going to catch them, this is probably pretty widespread. It's incredibly difficult to track down because it's really tedious reporting. Most farm workers don't keep all of their field cards and all of their paychecks over time to then sort of compare at the end of the day or the end of the year and see what's going on.
They're less likely to go to the authorities and say, hey, I'm not getting paid.
Much less likely. I mean,
and is that largely as a result of many being undocumented?
Yeah. And I have to say, you know, I obviously understood that it would be scary for people who are undocumented to be in the country, but living in community with folks, it really struck me. I mean, people are terrified. Like they see a police car coming down the street and they just go inside because they're scared. Any mention of the authorities for any reason, whether it's domestic violence or anything like that going on, people are really, really scared. And that's something I don't think I had fully grasped until I was living in those communities.
And you cite an economist from UC Davis, Philip Martin, who's looked at this question, and he calculates that even if you raise farm workers' wages by 40%, which is still not a great wage, but would move it from like $10,000 to $14,000 a year, the American family's average grocery bill would go up by only $16 for the entire year.
Right, and that's a function of the fact that the farm share of every dollar that you spend at the store is really quite small. On average, it's about 16 cents of every dollar goes back to the farm at the grocery store. When you're looking at fresh produce, it's higher. It's more like 20, 25, maybe 30%. Still not the majority of the price of what you're paying at the store. Most of what we pay for at the store is everything after the farm. So the distribution, the transportation, the logistics, the energy, you know, labor, all of that stuff. Interestingly, there was a study done by, I think it was the General Accounting Office, actually, in 2000 during the last minimum wage fight at the federal level. And they said, well, what would happen to food prices if we increased the minimum wage by about 10%? So at the time, it was around $5. So it was like, if you put it up to like $5.50 or $5.60, something like that. And they found that the price of groceries would increase by less than 1% across the board.
And yet people are not even getting paid minimum wage, is what you found in your research.
Right. So people aren't even getting minimum wage. And, you know, most of the formal data presumes that farm workers are getting paid minimum wage. There's very little documented sort of statistical analysis showing, you know, farm workers making less than minimum.
So before we move on to Walmart, I want to hear what mm-hmm. it was like there. What kind of food are the workers in the fields able to eat?
Right. Well, a lot of the more recent immigrants are still cooking a lot. So there's a lot of fairly fresh and simple food. But I did see, you know, a lot of that's the function of sort of bringing children into the sort of household labor. So the family that I lived with had a 14-year-old daughter who had just come up from Mexico in February. She was big enough to make the desert crossing, so her dad went down and brought her up. And her job was to provide all the domestic labor in this house. So we were living in a two-bedroom house. The main family, which was this girl's family, was of seven people, and they shared one bedroom together. There was a second family of four in another bedroom. I had a little cubby. And then there were between four and six single men living in the garage and a shed built off the back of it called a casita. So we had 16 or 17 people in this little house. And this girl cooked and cleaned for most of us. Sometimes the second family would prepare their own meals, but often we ate communally. And, you know, so we would eat these really great homemade stews, homemade tortillas every day, which was wonderful, you know, but it was because there was this 14-year-old girl who was providing that labor for us. And for me, that was, you know, initially before I realized, you know, she was doing that work and not going to school, I was like, this is great. I'm getting such great food. This is home cooking. This is like pobre cocina. I'm like, oh, it's so great. They said, oh, but it's because, you know, this girl is cooking for us and
not going to school.
Not going to school.
So one final thing you mentioned in your book is a thought that crossed your mind as you were picking in like 110 degree heat, which is, why the bleep would anybody grow food in a desert?
Right. Well, this is, you know, I think a product of me being from out east, right? I grew up in Michigan, which I can now say, having spent a lot of time in California, is an incredibly lush and verdant place. You know, and I've been mostly in New York for most of my adult life. Also, lots of green, lots of rain, no real problems with water out there. And so in my head, you know, I had this idea that, oh, those big farms in California, they're still green, right? And I had not really ever engaged with the fact that most of my fresh fruits and vegetables are actually coming from irrigated agriculture in a place that would not possibly support agriculture without serious human intervention. And that for me was really, that was a big mind shift for me. So that was very funny for me.
And that's Tracy McMillan. She's the author of The American Way of Eating. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. And let me take this opportunity to invite our listeners to join our conversation about the American way of eating and how it's evolving. You can call us at 1-866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you've been inside of the food industry, as Tracy has, as a picker or a canner or a food server, what do you want people to understand about our food system? We're also wondering who's doing great work in our communities around food justice, and what do you consider to be good food? Can you afford it? How do we eat in America that is different than in other countries? You can join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. Again, that's toll-free, 866-798-8255, or send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Tracy, so let's go to the second place that you've went, which is Walmart. Tell us about working inside of Walmart.
Sure. So, you know, I wanted to work at Walmart because it's the biggest grocer, and I decided I wanted to do that not on the coasts, right? I wanted to sort of be in sort of other parts of the U.S., and I'm from Michigan, so it was sort of an easy thing to say, oh, well, Michigan might work. And Michigan actually has very diverse agriculture. It grows a lot of fruits and vegetables. Advocates in Michigan will tell you that it's the second most diverse state after California. I haven't been able to vet that with any numbers, you know, but they grow a lot there. And so I said, oh, this will be interesting to sort of see how things move from farm to store. I wanted to work in produce, and I failed initially to get that job, and I had this idea that I would just bounce around. It would be really easy. It wasn't that easy, so I ended up doing about 5 weeks in grocery and about 5 weeks in produce at separate periods of time. And so I was on the night shift during the holiday season in the baking aisle on the west side of the state, which is very agricultural. And then I spent about a month working in produce outside of Detroit. I'm at a Walmart there. And so one of the things that for me was really shocking was first the realization that there is an incredible amount of labor involved in supermarkets. If you had asked me to sort of pick apart like how I thought the food got onto the shelves, I probably would have said robots, right? Like there's this idea
that may be coming to a store near you,
right?
But yeah.
I mean, and maybe not literally, right? But I didn't really think there were like that many people working at a Walmart. The food somehow would magically get on the shelves, sort of, right, is what I would have been thinking. So it was interesting for me to find that, you know, I was getting a really good workout. You know, I'd put up a half a ton of flour and sugar every night in 5 pound increments and be pulling like these huge pallets of stuff down the aisle. And then when I moved into produce, what was really striking for me was just how complicated it is to run a produce section and to take care of all that food. And, you know, the particular store I was at, I was just shocked at how poorly it was run. They had put a 20-year-old kid in charge of the produce section, and he didn't really know anything about what he was doing. He clearly hadn't been trained very well. And so, you know, we had this sort of endless comedy of errors where, you know, I spent an afternoon throwing out 200 pounds of asparagus because it had just sort of been rotting in the cooler and nobody had bothered to rotate it out or note that it was going bad or anything like that. There was a leak in the ceiling of the cooler. So we had like buckets of water overflowing in the cooler for about the first month that I was working there. And then, you know, food was getting moldy. And, you know, I had this heartbreaking moment where this woman from the deli section came over to me. And most Walmart workers actually do their grocery shopping at Walmart because they get a discount in addition to the convenience, right? You get a 10% discount for shopping in store. And she said, Tracy, I'm so sorry, but do you know what I can do? I bought 3 green peppers yesterday and they looked fine, but when I got them home, they were full of mold. I said, I don't know what to tell you, but yeah, there's a mold problem in the cooler. You know, we need to work on that. But, you know, sort of nothing was ever changing or happening. And for me, that was really interesting because Walmart makes this pitch that it's got this great economy of scale and corporate efficiency. And that seemed to me to sort of break down when it came to something like produce that, you know, a bag of sugar, you don't need to do much more to it than you do a box with sneakers in it, right? You just put it on the shelf and it'll rot eventually, but, you know, it takes a while. Produce is really different. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons that Walmart's prices on produce actually aren't cheaper usually than you'll find in local stores. Maybe a sale item or two will be. But on average, you know, I did a price comparison between Walmart and the local grocery store near my house in Detroit. And produce was actually 7% cheaper in Detroit at a little independent grocer than it was at Walmart. When you sort of compare to Market Basket, and fresh meat was 17% cheaper at the little market instead of at Walmart.
So what do you attribute that to?
Well, the thing is that Walmart, like any, I mean, all grocery stores do this where they play with sort of, I think of it as a pricing cocktail for what their margin is on different items. And so some things they use to bring people into the store at low prices, some things they always make a lot of money off of. Walmart, because it's usually operating in a super center format where it has, you know, all these other things besides food and grocery in it, they can lead off like their entire grocery section if they choose to. They can also decide while they want to make market share, like if they open a new store in a neighborhood, if they say, well, we really want to be competitive and sort of get rid of some of the competition. They're such a giant corporation, they could just decide to take a loss on a store for a while if they wanted. And because they have that kind of flexibility, it makes it incredibly difficult for smaller grocers to compete with them.
Which is why you say, or I think this is why you say that it can lead to food deserts in other parts of, that the Walmartization can lead to food deserts in other parts of cities.
Right. I mean, what happens when Walmart comes into a city, right, is it can begin to eat up all the market share. And so what you'll have is you'll end up with like a fewer number of Walmarts. And far fewer small stores, right? And so you'll still have food access in those communities, but there'll be much less competition. And competition is the main thing that lowers prices, right? And so if you start seeing, there's actually a USDA report showing that in communities where Walmart and other supercenters are still establishing market share, right? So they're still really trying to compete with local stores. Their prices are usually about 10, 11% lower than the competitors. If you're in a community where Walmart is making up like a significant portion of the food retail, the difference drops to about 5%. And when you're looking at something like 5%, I think opportunity costs start to really play because a 5% difference, you know, on a $100 a week grocery bill, that's $5. Well, gas, time, things like that, that's something fairly fungible for folks.
But a big, big store like Walmart does have the power to make great changes to affect the food distribution in huge ways, like by starting to buy organic or going green, right? So there are some potentially positive things that a giant could do too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, any large retailer, because of the nature of their, because they're so big, right, that what they demand from their producers and suppliers is going to have a huge ripple effect. And so there's definitely a way to affect positive change going that route. I just really felt like the more I did this reporting, the more I felt, you know, I'm not really that comfortable with the fact that there's one company in charge of a quarter of our food supply. And a lot of communities, right, the 25% number is a national average. Most communities where Walmart is operating, it's 50%, 60%, 70%. So the neighborhood I worked in the produce section, the Walmart was one of two grocery stores in the neighborhood. So this 20-year-old kid that didn't know what he was doing was in charge of half that town's food supply for fresh food. And I found that really problematic.
That's Tracy McMillan. She is the author of The American Way of Eating, and you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. You can join our conversation about food distribution, food supply, access to healthy food by calling 1-866-798-TALK. That number again is toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. What are you doing to eat more sustainably and eat in a way that doesn't exploit workers, if you even think about that? And have you changed the ways in which you get your food in the past few years? Do you garden and cook? And when you go out for food, what considerations do you make? We also are really interested to hear from people who have been inside of the food industry as a picker, a canner, a food server. What do you think people need to understand about our food systems and what we're eating? You can join us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. All right, so before we get to Applebee's, how are you seeing big food changing? Is the movement toward healthier eating and Michelle Obama's big drive to end obesity, is any of that having an effect on big food systems, industrial ag?
Yeah, particularly when we're talking about sort of national food policy, right? Michelle Obama's initiatives around this have been really powerful, particularly for just focusing attention on it, I think. And certainly there is a healthy food financing initiative that was part of that. So that's funding to help encourage grocery store development in underserved areas. And I think that's great. There's been a lot of focus on the part of the Obama administration on working with Walmart under the logic that, you know, Walmart's a really big player. We can have sort of a win-win here. And I think that I want people to have grocery stores, right? So that's great. Bringing in Walmart's fine. But I think we need to have a nuanced conversation about whether or not that's in our long-term best interest in terms of sort of food, having our food supply be stable and something we can all afford, because no company has an interest in charging lower prices if they don't have to, right? I mean, it's particularly a publicly traded company like Walmart. Like, they have a responsibility to their shareholders to increase their profits. One way to do that is to raise prices in the markets where they can.
And there's this whole pushback movement, which is to buy more locally, to look for food sources that are very close to where you are. That's a lot easier, I'd say, in California than it might be
much easier
in, you know, New York or Michigan.
Right. I mean, obviously, buying locally is great when folks can do it and when the local food shed, you know, supports that. Detroit, where I was doing a lot of the reporting, has an amazing rich and varied food shed, particularly with the agriculture going on in greenhouses in California, in Canada, across the river. And so, you know, that's all really exciting stuff going on. And there's a lot of interesting work going on right now to sort of rebuild local food infrastructure under the USDA's Food Hubs program. So this is sort of smart, targeted investment to help small growers and small grocers sort of link up and rebuild some of these networks. Because a lot of the way that Walmart makes its food cheap isn't just pressuring suppliers, but it's creating this sort of very consolidated distribution network that it can sort of cut costs on. And that's something that small producers and small grocers can't possibly do on their own, right? Like, you need a lot of capital to build your own warehouses and have your own, like, truck fleet.
So we just have 1 minute before the break and a full bank of calls. I'll give out the number in just one moment. But what kind of awareness did you find among the workers at Walmart and Applebee's about these issues, about wanting to eat healthily and whether or not they could access those choices?
Right. I mean, most people aren't thinking really concretely and heavily about their food. But when I would ask them, like, why are you eating that junk food? What I got back was, it's cheap and it's easy and it's right here. Right. So it was never, I think this is the best food for me and this is what I prefer and I would never eat good food if it was put in front of me. It was always, well, this is cheap and easy and it's what I can afford. So this is what I'm eating. You know, on Fridays, Walmart has a free fruit Friday. Right. So they put out these bins of produce for workers in the break room. And that thing was picked over by, like, lunchtime. You know, people actually really did eat it when it was put out for them. So I really felt like, you know, there's more going on here than an innate preference for junk food.
How does that fit in with what your grandma told you about sort of, you know, cooking and spending a lot of time on food is for fancy people?
Right. Well, I should point out, my grandmother's an amazing home cook and would take us to farmers markets and things like that, right? Because I think there's a bit of a cultural disconnect, because a lot of the discussion about, like, oh, we take our food seriously tends to come from a cultural expression of a lot of money. And so I think my grandmother and a lot of folks like that just sort of react to that and say, oh, you're talking down to me, I don't do that, even though they do cook.
And that's a good point for us to pick up on after the break, which is this idea that eating well is an elitist thing to do. We're speaking with Tracy McMillan. She's the author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. We're talking about the food distribution system in the U.S. and why it costs so much more to eat healthy food than processed foods. And we also want to take your calls. What do you consider good food, and can you afford it? Who's doing great work in food justice, and tell us what's going on in your community? And is how we eat in America different than in other countries? And is our food system affecting global food supplies and how others eat? You can join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW San Francisco, and we've been broadcasting at 91.7 on the FM dial since 1941. Now, with online listening, KALW has listeners worldwide, but just because you live in the Bay Area doesn't mean that KALW's online streams aren't for you, because if you hear KALW at work but not at home, or lose reception on your commute, check out the online listening options at kalw.org. Whether you're on your desktop, your tablet, or your smartphone, you can stay connected. Just click on the Listen Live link at the top of kalw.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, after the fatal shooting of an unarmed black teenager by a Florida Neighborhood Watch volunteer, what is the status of civil rights in 2012? Friday, of course, is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about the week's news coverage. And today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Tracy McMillan. She's the author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. McMillan writes that seeing good food as a luxury product has been so deeply embedded in our thinking about meals that we barely notice it. So how is the American way of eating evolving? I'll give out the number in just a minute because we have a full bank of calls to get to. You can also post comments at our new website, which is yourcallradio.org. And I want to let everybody know that Tracy will be reading and doing a book signing at Omnivore Books in Noe Valley tonight, right? Tomorrow night from 6 to 7. Let me say that again. She'll be reading and signing books at Omnivore Books in Noe Valley in San Francisco tomorrow night from 6 to 7 p.m. And we'll put a link to that information at yourcallradio.org. So let's go straight to calls. Let's hear from Carlisle in Carmel Valley. Hi, Carlisle.
Yeah, hi. I have been an organic farmer at Alba, which is an organic farm incubator in south of Salinas. And they do a really good job in training farmers. And I think that we need more federal funds for these farm incubators. That's number one, and that would transform the system. And number two, I think that we need to discuss with city councils the importance of having farmers markets, because that's where the farmer gets has direct marketing and gets most of the money, and that's where the people get access and the education to good, healthy food, and it becomes a cultural thing. I mean, basically, it just feels like, somewhere in the 50s, everything was hijacked by, supermarkets and all that. And I think we kind of need to move more in that direction. But it does take government discussing with the city council, and also discuss with your congressman that, we want these farm incubators because we need more farmers.
Farm incubators. Thanks, Carla. Why don't you stay on the line and get a response from Tracy? One of the things Tracy says in her book is that a central point of my book is that both private enterprise and government have failed Americans when it comes to providing us with good, healthy food.
Right. So right now, right, we've got this food distribution and marketing system that doesn't always get people really good food. I think farmers markets are a really good sort of first step in getting good access to folks and providing good prices to farmers. And I've been really heartened to see how much success there are with farmers markets in low-income neighborhoods, particularly when you've got things like the WIC FMNP program. Mm-hmm.
Women, infant, and children. Yeah.
Right, which is actually being cut this year. So there's a fight about that. But, you know, there is demand in neighborhoods for that. I also do think, though, that there's a role for places like supermarkets. You've got to figure out how to make that profitable for small growers, because that's important. But not everybody can go to the farmers market on Saturday. So I know, like, when I worked at Applebee's in New York, I did an interview recently where someone said, oh, so were you going to the farmers market? And I was like, oh, well, I worked Friday night until 1 in the morning and then again on Saturday at noon. So, no, I didn't go because that just wasn't possible.
Well, another thing that you mentioned is that when we do go to farmers markets, we should probably be asking the farmers there who picks the food and how they're paid.
Right. Well, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what do we do as consumers. And one of the easiest things to do when you're thinking about labor issues is just to bring it up as part of your concern as a consumer. And a lot of farmers will be happy to talk to you about how they're handling that, and they think creatively about it and very thoughtfully. And some folks are sort of like, I didn't really think that was important to you. So I think just having that discussion is a really important first step.
That's great. Okay, so thank you so much, Carla. Let's go to Jeff in San Francisco. Welcome to your call.
Yes, hi, my name's Jeff, and I worked in the restaurant industry for 20 years and never had health insurance, sick days, vacation days, et cetera. And so what this meant was that if I was sick, I had to work almost all the time, which is a huge link in our society's food chain. And this meant as a cook, as a waiter, et cetera, I am almost always working when I'm sick.
And is that changing at all? I thought San Francisco now had Healthy San Francisco that everybody could sign up for.
Well, that's this a new was before. Uh-huh. thing, and that's only in San Francisco. And I don't know. I never had a job I worked at, so I don't know if that's certain types of restaurants. My last job was a bartender, and I never had it. So I don't know the statistics on that new law.
So, Jeff, that's obviously bad for your health, but it also, if you're in a restaurant and serving food, it seems like it would be bad for the public's health as well.
Yes, this is a weak link in the chain.
Well, let's have Tracy respond to that, because you haven't told us at all about your Applebee's experience. Thank you so much, Jeff, for calling. And if you want to join our conversation with Tracy McMillan, the author of The American Way of Eating, you can join us at 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 1-866-798-8255. And let's hear from Tracy about Applebee's.
Right. So this question Jeff brings up about sort of health at work and what that means when you don't have sick days, but you're serving food, so a lot of people end up working sick. You know, the Restaurant Opportunity Center has actually done a bit of data collection on this, and there's a very strong correlation between jobs violating health and safety violations that affect consumers and also violating workers' rights in terms of not paying for overtime or cheating them out of wages and things like that. So it's a really important conversation to have and to start linking work conditions to sort of like the food that people are eating, right? And some of this, I think, is also just a shift in consciousness in terms of being like, look, food is not like other consumer products, right? It's edible, right? And it's part of our health. It's part of what we have to do to live. And so, you know, it doesn't matter so much if someone is sneezing on the sneaker in the factory. It matters a lot if someone is sneezing on your salad.
And how often does that happen? What are some of the things that you saw at Applebee's? I believe you had a quote, you don't even want to know about some of this stuff.
Well, you know, I was lucky enough that I didn't fall sick when I was working at Applebee's, but definitely some of the wait staff would come in and they'd be like, oh, I'm so sick. And I've worked in restaurants in the past, and it's absolutely true. You know, as with any job where you're not salaried, if you're going to lose wages by not going into work when you're sick, you just go in unless you can't walk, basically. And that's, you know, a piece of American work culture that has to be sort of dealt with, and particularly, you know, the shift towards just hourly work and that people are just going to be paid minimum wage and only if they show up, and not investing in workers as sort of, you know, folks that need a steady income. You know, that changes how things work.
And that's an interesting idea of marrying these kinds of ideas of public health and safety with workers' rights and social justice. Let's go to Rochelle in Marin. Hi, Rochelle.
Hi. My question is about more about labeling and truth in labeling. I know there's coming up legislation in California for GMOs to be properly labeled, and then the American Almond Association just passed about raw almonds being actually pasteurized? And do you think it seems like there's more focus from the government on preservation of food, not necessarily alive food, but it's making sure that it's safety, and they're saying it's to promote safety. But when you're eating a food that's dead, how is that actually promoting health? And how much impact does that have, does Walmart have, or big buyers like that have, on our food distribution and the proper labeling?
Rochelle, are you saying that as we sort of pasteurize and do more to the food, that maybe it loses some of its quality? Is that your concern?
It loses some of its vitality, its aliveness, the nutrients in it, or the enzymes that are naturally in it. If it's pasteurized, that's killed. It's killed the germs, but it also kills the vital energy that's in the food itself.
Right. So obviously, and thanks so much for that question. You know, places like Walmart aren't really concerned with that, right? Like, they operate primarily on the income that they get from processed food. And this is actually something I go into in the book in terms of the history of supermarkets. Supermarkets started in 1930 pretty much as industrial agriculture and industrial food processing came into their own. And it was sort of this moment of saying, like, oh, look, we could just do this with food. We could do this industrial scale food distribution. People could put food in boxes and people could pull it out. And I think that there was there's a way in which it almost makes sense, right? Because before then, food could not make you sick, really, unless it was poisoned or rotten, right? But, like, eating food, like, nobody really got fat. Nobody really got sick from food. So how could that be a bad thing? And you know, 80, 90 years later, we're seeing how that could be a bad thing. But, you know, supermarkets, their business model relies very heavily on having shelf-stable products that they can sort of buy in bulk, particularly a place like Walmart, buy or have produced in bulk and sell off as, you know, they feel like it, as opposed to being worried about, you know, heads of lettuce that are going to rot within a week, you know, even if it's, like, less vital than it was when it was in the field. So there's a real predisposition to a diet heavy with processed food and dry goods when you're working with a supermarket model.
And let's go to, that's Tracy McMillan. She's the author of The American Way of Eating. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. You can join our conversation about food safety, food distribution, and food justice by calling 866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. We're particularly interested to hear from people who are growers, pickers, food servers, et cetera. What's your experience with the food system, and how can we change it to make the system that we want? 1-866-798-8255. And let's go to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. I wanted to tell you about two things. One is that I have the good fortune to live about four blocks from the Alemany Farmers Market, and so that's where I get my wonderful fresh fruits and vegetables picked the day before and not chucked in over a long distance for good prices, actually. And also I wanted to tell you that I've stopped shopping at Trader Joe's because Trader Joe's has refused to sign something that would help the Haitian tomato growers, pickers in Florida. Those people are living, a lot of them, pretty much in slave conditions, and they've managed to organize some little organization of their own, not quite a union, that's created the Fair Farm Agreement.
So Judy, my producer is saying that Trader Joe's actually did sign this agreement.
Oh, they did?
That's what I'm understanding. We can vet that. It sounds
so
like Tracy.
Ago.
Yeah, I guess it happened very recently.
Oh, that's wonderful. So then everybody go back to shopping at Trader Joe's.
You can shop at Trader Joe's guilt free. Well, let's get Tracy though to comment on this idea of where we should shop. What's the impact of those choices?
Right. Well, I think something that's important to look at with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is the group Judy's mentioning, is that, you know, they've sort of done this runaround from growers saying, look, we can't possibly afford to pay people more, and they said, well, most of the power in the food system is at the retail level. So that, you know, Coalition of Immokalee Workers just said, okay, well, we'll just talk to people that are buying this stuff and put pressure on the sort of institutional purchasing. And they've had a lot of success with that, you know, and I think that's a really important thing to sort of engage with and start having this discussion, right, about whether or not labor conditions matter. And so I've been really excited to see the success CIW has had. I'm sure they're going to find more institutional purchasers to sort of battle with.
You can join our conversation at Your Call by calling 1-866-798-8255. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. You can also continue this discussion by making comments at our new website, which is yourcallradio.org. And let's go to Rita. Hi, Rita. You're in Berkeley, right?
Yes. Hello. I would just like to mention that I think that it's not only access to food that is important, but I also think learning and knowing how to cook is essential. I was a checker in a grocery store for many years, and one thing I noticed is that the non-immigrant population was buying almost everything they bought was like processed foods, frozen foods, and they wouldn't buy anything that required you to cook. And I noticed like the Russian immigrant population and the Mexican immigrant population, people from Africa, they use their food stamps to buy things that you would use to cook, like giant, good, healthy meals like cabbage and potatoes. And they knew how to use fresh fruits and vegetables and food that's good for you. But I think it's important as a culture for us to sort of take away cooking from the elite. And it just seems like the poor people in our country have forgotten that it's okay for them to cook too.
Well, Rita, that's a really good point. And in studies I've seen show that first-generation immigrants do cook and generally have lots of grocery stores in the neighborhoods that they live in. It's the second generation of Americans that tends to move into this processed food, this fast food. And I think, Tracy, you said that somebody said to you after reading the book, you know, well, people like fast food. Nobody's going to change their mind about this.
Right. So, I mean, cooking, I think, is really, really key. And I appreciate Rita bringing this up. You know, I talk about it a little bit in the book as like a key part of self-sufficiency. And I think that most of the discussion that we have publicly about cooking is that of it as this sort of cultural, luxurious thing. And actually, it's just basic self-sufficiency. People need to know how to cook because they need to eat. And we shouldn't have to rely on big companies or government, right, to tell us what to eat or how to eat, right? Like we're intelligent people. We can figure out how to cook, but we need to have those skills. Something that I do think is interesting is when you look at the data on how much time people spend cooking, low-income people already spend about twice as much time cooking as high-income people. So folks are cooking to some degree. Families often are incorporating convenience foods into their diets.
So why is this framed as elitist?
I mean, I think...
Who's making that frame?
Well, I think a lot of it is just, honestly, that the traditional sort of market for writing about food has been gourmands, right? Mm-hmm. And so food writing comes out of this tradition of gourmandism, and that the way that you, if you're taking food seriously, is you write about it in this very high culture way. And I feel like generationally there's a shift, right, that there's much more mixing of high and low, and much more of an appreciation of the fact that, you know, food is really awesome for everybody, not just rich people, and that we need to have a conversation about food that engages with, like, all of American society, not just the folks that can spend, you know, tons of money on, you know, fancy tomatoes and foie gras and all that stuff, which is all delicious, you know, but you need to sort of have a broader discussion.
Let me ask you about Rush Limbaugh's rant about you and your book, calling you the latest feminazi obsession, an authorette and a wide-eyed college grad. Recent college grad. And then he said, what is it with all of these young, single white women? Overeducated doesn't mean intelligent. So I'm not quite sure what his objection to your book was, but what was that like for you, and did it help with the book? Did it help popularize the book?
So Limbaugh actually spent about 45 minutes talking about me in the book on air. Most of this was actually about the book, and what he had done is he seized on my saying, look, maybe we should talk about public investment in food infrastructure so that we can link small producers and grocers together, and said that this represented a war on freedom and a war on private enterprise, and that, you know, this was sort of, I think it was a different reviewer said, you know, doesn't Macmillan know that the Soviet Union failed? I'm like, I didn't actually suggest we go back to mandated food production a la the Soviet Union. So, you know, some of it was actually, I think, a sincere political disagreement, right, about the role of the state and what Americans need or don't need. And then it kind of just seemed like Rush couldn't quite help himself. And he just was like, oh, there's this woman, this working class woman writing about her food, and she doesn't have any right to do that, right? And there's this interesting conflation of, you know, the fact that I have a college degree with my being some sort of elitist. And, you know, it was really funny for me. I'm like, well, I understand the impulse to sort of like sneer upwardly at like people with like multiple PhDs and stuff, because sometimes folks with that level of education, they just sort of function in a different part of society than a lot of Americans. And I understand that compulsion. At the same time, you know, I'm like, I have a BA and I put myself through school. The last I heard, you know, that wasn't actually something women weren't supposed to do.
Welcome to the 21st century.
Yeah.
You're listening to Your Call. That's Tracy McMillan. She's the author of The American Way of Eating, and that's what we're talking about on Your Call. And we're asking you if you garden and cook, and have you changed the way in which you get your food in the past few years? And when you go out for food, what considerations do you make? And what questions do you have for Tracy about the way that the American way of eating is evolving? Is how we eat in America different than in other countries? And how do we change the equation if we don't like the way the food distribution industry is feeding us? It's 1-866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 1-866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Jonathan. Hi, Jonathan. Jonathan and Marin. Hi, Jonathan.
How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
I wanted to kind of piggyback on the last comments about the education system. I live in Marin County, and my son goes to a public high school. He's a senior in a very wealthy neighborhood and was taking economics. And the best assignment that I think he's had in high school was the requirement to shop at the poverty level, that's the federal poverty level, for the amount of money that you're given to eat off of. And it was an extraordinarily enlightening skill for him, because he wouldn't have even been able to take the bus to go shopping. He would have had to have walked, and it would have been a considerable day's event just to go shopping. But he ended up, you know, buying butternut squash, hard butternut squash, and baking it himself, hard black beans and rice, and cooking in a crock pot the black beans for, you know, 12 hours.
And what were some of the takeaways for him after doing that, and for your whole family, I guess, you know, seeing this and experiencing it together?
I think the unrealistic expectation that people can live in this society at that kind of income level, or that kind of remuneration, you know, if they were to live with federal assistance.
And that's a lot of what Tracy experienced in her book, in the research.
Exactly. And so I thought that having high school students in a very wealthy neighborhood have to go through the same experiment was enlightening. And also the fact that, you know, he was lucky. He grew up in a home where there wasn't a lot of processed foods, and he does know how to cook rice and bake his own beans and such. But I think a lot of the fellow students were challenged with trying to find nutritious food, because part of the requirement was also to look at the nutrition that they were getting from the kind of food they were eating. And I can't remember exactly the dollar amount, but it was something like less than $5 a day.
Wow, Jonathan, that's fascinating. I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm going to bring that to my daughter's school as an idea as well. Because we're running out of time, I'd like to try and get to a few more calls before the hour's over. Jane in Santa Cruz, welcome to your call.
Yes, I wanted to talk about, because I feel like this is rarely talked about, is there an actual lowering of the yield of items, for instance, potatoes and onions? Because if you go to Trader Joe's, for instance, you will get four large onions for like $2.25. And I just wonder what is happening with the poor people, when generally you used to be able to buy a large bag. How are you feeding a large family when a large bag of potatoes is like, you know, a 5-pound bag of potatoes, like $6?
What are you finding, Tracy? And how has this changed the way you buy food and eat it?
Right. So it was really interesting for me to have to go and shop right on these budgets. And so I've had this instance when I was taking my first job at Walmart, where I said, okay, I'm going to be a very smart and responsible shopper, and I'm going to go buy everything in bulk because I'll get better prices for that, right? Which would sort of be the same thing as buying a 5 or 6 pound bag of potatoes, right? Like, okay, I'm going to buy a bunch of stuff because I'll get a cheaper unit price. And I got a couple weeks into it, and I realized I had tied up all of my money in grain futures, essentially. So I had a lot of oats, I had a lot of rice, I had flour and things like that. and I didn't have enough money for rent. So that really changed the way that I thought about what's a smart way to shop, because if you can't afford to buy the big bulk item up front because your expenses are that tight, right, you're going to end up paying more money for your food. And I also found, interestingly, you know, I've cooked my whole life pretty much since it's about 7 or 8. It's when I started learning how to cook. And I've always really enjoyed it. I'm like one of those home cook people. But as soon as it stopped being a choice, as soon as I was sitting there with my wheat and my oats, and I said, well, either I'm going to eat raw flour or I'm going to bake bread and have to wait 2 hours to eat, I didn't like baking bread anymore, right? And I didn't like cooking. Like, it's much less fun when you're like, oh, I have to do this. And it's really changed how I think about cooking, because now, as much as I enjoy it, I just try to remind myself, like, this is a basic human task that I have to perform. I don't have to like it. I just have to do it, the same way that, you know, I have to take a shower every day. I'm not super into it, but I do it every day because that's part of sort of, you know, like being a human. And so that's how I take care of myself. And for me, it's been kind of liberating, right, to just be like, this is just, I just have to do it. Like, there's no way around it. And I found that, you know, tends to work out pretty well for me.
Okay, so we're running up on our last 2 minutes of the program. What advice do you have for people? What can people do if they care about food safety, social justice in the fields and conditions that workers are working in, as well as, like I said, some of the public health aspects of this? What's concrete information for people? What can they do?
Right, well, I think one thing is just to sort of pay attention to labor as part of the food system. So if you're going to the farmer's market, ask the farmers that you're buying from how they deal with labor. The Restaurant Opportunity Center created a dining out guide about labor conditions at a lot of chain restaurants that you can get off the internet, and that's sort of a good basic guide. But just asking about it and having a conversation about it, we've tended to ignore it. And then I think the other thing, right, is, you know, if folks are inclined, like, growing your own food is a really great way to have fresh, healthy stuff that you know what's going into it. And I think it also makes you more likely to cook because it's really good. And also learning to cook, I think that's a really important piece of self-sufficiency. And, you know, we need to have a conversation about that as something we should all be learning.
And maybe you could start a food justice column in some of these fancy magazines like Bon Appetit and Savoir and Gourmet. Right?
Well, I am finished with the book now. So if any editors are listening, like, please feel free to get in touch.
All right. Well, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thanks.
It's been a pleasure. We've been speaking with Tracy McMillan. She's the author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and The Dinner Table. And she's going to be speaking tomorrow night. She'll be reading and signing books at Omnivore Books in Noe Valley in San Francisco. That's at 3885A Cesar Chavez Street. She'll be there from 6 to 7 p.m. That's tomorrow night. We'll put a link to that and other web resources at our new website. It's yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can continue these conversations by posting your comments at yourcallradio.org. And thanks to everybody who joined us. Thank you for your calls and emails, and I apologize that we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How are you responding to the killing of Trayvon Martin? On the Next Your Call, we'll talk about neighborhood watch and stand your ground laws. There are 21 around the country, including in Florida, where in February an unarmed teenager was shot to death by a neighbor, calling it self-defense. When local officials didn't arrest the shooter, Justice Department officials stepped in. What do shoot-first laws mean? And what civil rights progress has there been? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also friend us on Facebook. Ali Budner and Malihe Razazan produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.